Well, hi everybody. Oh my God, I'm big on my own screen. How do I get out of that?
There we go. I'll unpin you.
Yeah, I'd rather look at all of you than me. Hi, thank you. Oh, by the way, though, I do want, you know, I wish you would have seen this little necklace that I am wearing. Oh, well, it's not going to work, but it's cool. Too late. It was given to me by a dear friend, and I just wanted to share it. And I have some dear friends on this talk tonight. I'm happy to see all of you. And I hope we all hear something we need to hear. Definitely me. And I hope I'll say something that's of value to you guys. So my name is Judy, and I'm a recovering compulsive overeater. Welcome to you newcomer people. Gee. I can still remember my first meeting. I started the program November 22nd, 1974. And that was 4 days before Thanksgiving. And the week before, I had been leading a workshop in my local YWCA. And a woman got up there. I asked people to, you know, say something they liked about themselves. And this woman got up and she said, I have just lost 30 pounds at Overeaters Anonymous. And I was like, what? Overeaters Anonymous? I was an expert in alcoholism. I had been taking alcoholics to AA meetings for years. I lived in Los Angeles, which was the birthplace of Overeaters Anonymous. I had sat in staffings crying, how come no one can help me? There's help for alcoholics. And the shrink in charge said, you're right. There's no help for people like you. You've always been that way. You're always going to be that way. I weighed 222 pounds. I had dieted my way up to that. And I believed there was no help for people like me. Just to cry, to cry. And here was this woman saying, there was such a thing as Overeaters Anonymous. None of us in alcoholism had ever heard of it. So that was the Friday before the following Monday. She told me the meeting was at a library, and I went there. You know, I was of two minds. You know, I loved my intellect, and I loved what I knew as a counselor, and I was very kind of not puffed up about that, but grateful about it, and I didn't want to discard it. And at the same time, I just knew I could not stop eating. Every single morning, I swore off with firm resolve. And by 3 p.m, I was in a bag of something crunchy and on through the night. Every day. So I dragged myself to that meeting. And I'm grateful, and a lot to this day. I sit in the back of the room quietly and I listen. I come to these meetings to hear what I'm supposed to hear. And a lot of times I think, why am I hearing this? Oh my God, she's talking about that. Oh, I worked through that in graduate school. I've got all my judgments and all of my stuff around it. But I listen and I take it in. Because I don't know if next week I'm not going to have to remember what I heard at that meeting, you know? Even though I might not appreciate it at the time. So, anyway, I judged everyone at the meeting. I thought their muumuus weren't as nice as mine. You know, I had a colorful muumuu, and I had, you know, sexy flip-flops, all the things I could fit into. And I wanted to separate myself. I'm not this bad. I don't need this. But something in my heart knew that what they said was true, that this is the last house on the block. And I had already tried everything else. So I'm so grateful that I stayed. At the end of the meeting, oh, and I didn't like what most people said because they were full of gratitude, gratitude, gratitude. Oh God, couldn't stand it. Gratitude or God, 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 gratitude, shut up. That's how I felt. But then there was a speaker who got up And she was angry as hell. You just knew she was going to leave that meeting and kill somebody. I mean, when she spoke, it was like electric off her head, right to me in the back row. And I said, now there's my kind of people. So I went up to her after the meeting and I asked her to be my sponsor. And that's how it started. She left town within 3 days. I don't think it was my fault, but she fell by the wayside, never heard from her again, but I stayed. And at the end of that meeting, I went to the literature table and a woman named Jocelyn was there who I loved for years and years and years. And, you know, I've been in the program 47 years, so I've been through a lot of people here. And I said, you know, I like all but the God part. I just cannot take this God talk. And she said, well, it might help if you do what I do. And this is what the Quakers do. They say God is the still small voice within. So maybe, you know, you can spend your time just trying to listen for that still small voice within. And that was very helpful to me. And that has worked for me throughout these 47 years and an 85-pound weight loss and a life unimaginable. I'll tell you a little as we go. But I began that day four days before Thanksgiving. I will say that Thanksgiving morning, I woke up crying and shaking. You know, the fourth day of sugar withdrawals is the worst. That's why we always give up our resolve on Thursday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Oh, I'm going to a wedding on Sunday. I may as well eat, you know. But the lady told me to go. I called her and I was crying and she said, go sit in a room and write. And I always send people off to write because that's what helps me listen to my still small voice within or my angels or my guardian or my goddess or whatever you want to call it. But I can't always take what's ruminating around in my head. I have to get some clarity. You know, in the 60s, we used to say, well, reality is for people who can't handle drugs. Well, now in recovery, we have to say that same thing. Reality is for those of us who can't handle drugs. We have to live in reality. We have to listen for our own personal reality. I'm not just listening for my sponsor's reality or the speaker's reality or the book's reality even. I'm here on a journey. You know, in the book it says, if you want what we have, you'll do what we do, blah, blah. Well, I don't want what you have, but I seek what you seek. We are seeking the same integrity of knowing the truth, our truth, and living by it. At least that's what I believe, and I hope I'll get to talk about that some today. And anyway, one of the things that came to me while I was writing that morning was stay on the path. I had a vision of myself when I was 5, and I won't go into the details. It's in a lot of other tapes that I've done that I can, you know, if you email me, my email's under my name, I'll send you where you can get all that other stuff. But the message was stay on the path. And that's what I've done for 47 years. My food plans have changed. My lifestyle has changed. My physicality has changed. Millions and millions of changes, but I have not left Overeaters Anonymous. In fact, I had a very harrowing week this week that I hope I'll get to tell you a little about. And people say, well, what are you doing speaking at that meeting? You know, you're in such distress. And I say, where else would I be? What else would I do? This was already arranged. And where am I going to hear the truth of what I need to hear, if not at these meetings? And in our Al-Anon book, the ODAT book, there was a story I had lost for years. I kept trying to find it. And a guy at the Al-Anon meeting this week quoted that story. And it was about a woman who saw the minister walking up her path during World War II. And she knew he was coming to tell her that her husband had died. And what the story said is that she invited him in for tea. What would you normally do in the heat of all of this? What is your usual and customary? And that's kind of the message that I get over and over, is just keep it simple and do what you have to do. But we'll see how that turns out. Anyway, you know, I had a big plan for all these great important things I was going to tell you tonight. But like I say, plans changed. But I wrote down a couple of them, and I want to make sure that I get these in. Like, I think the basic things I learned when I got here and have lasted for me is, what was once my comforter has become my punisher. I think that's so important. It's not that I hate food. Today, I love food. I savor food. I enjoy my food. But the way I was using it as a comforter, I thought, to comfort me in distressing times, was not. It was a punisher. It was to keep me on the treadmill of fear and self-loathing and degradation. Despite all of my training as a therapist, I came here as a rudderless ship. I had no direction. And most of the way the boat kind of flopped around in the water took me to degradation. I had a lot of experiences before I got here of really degrading myself. And that came from childhood. A lot of our stuff does. I was a battered child, and I grew up to be a battered wife. And despite all my accomplishments, I somehow still stayed in battering situations. But stay on the path. I'll just tell you that last year, I was attending a one of these, you know, these marathon meetings. I go to a lot of Zoom meetings. I love Zoom. And this is one of those marathon day-long things. And this woman, it was an AA thing, and this woman spoke, and she had 59 years of sobriety in AA. And she had gone to a conference early on, and she was the roommate of Chuck C. and his wife. And some of you from Los Angeles know Chuck C., the father of Richard Chamberlain, the actor. But Chuck C. was a very big speaker in AA, and he was like totally spiritual. And he wrote a book called A New Pair of Glasses, and how we'd get a different view when we were in recovery, and we'd learn so many cool things. He was wonderful. He did workshops on Thursday nights, and we all gathered there, and we could ask him questions, and it was fabulous. Anyway, so here she was, the roommate of Chuck C. and his wife, at this AA convention. I think it was in Texas. And who did they wheel in a wheelchair but Bill W., the father of AA, wheeled him into the room. And he just looked at her and he said, hello. And he said to her, stay on the path. I could have had a V8. I couldn't believe it. That was just what I needed to hear. And Bill W. said it. Anyway, so just renewed my resolve. Okay. So the first few years, most of my attention was about my food and staying on the food plan. However, my husband intervened. I lost 60 pounds my first year, and my husband lost his job for the first time due to his alcoholism. When he would beat me, it was in blackouts. And the next day, he would look at me and say, where'd you get those bruises? And I'd say, you did that. And he would be mortified. And I understand. Anyway, he lost his job again. A lot happened. We eventually divorced. He died vomiting blood across the emergency room of the hospital where I worked on the fourth floor in the alcoholism program. So I certainly learned that I could not heal those that I love. And I also learned a lot of lessons about knowing the truth and doing the right thing. The first time he called me to get him out of jail, drunk driving, my body just started shaking. And I said, I can't do that. And I hung up the phone. And I'm an alcoholism counselor, remember, right? So I know that's the right thing to do, but my body could not do it. And I called my sponsor. I said, did I do the right thing? She said, yes, you did the right thing. So let me talk to what happened Monday to get that out of the way, and then I can go on kind of with past stuff. But it's an example of a lot of things. My husband, who I love very much, he's been the love of my life for the last 28 years, and we have a great time and a lot of good stuff. And we've both mellowed each other. We were both kind of angry people. He, of course, more so, right? But anyway, he never showed it all that much because he got to act it out in road rage. I mean, if someone cut him off, he would drive 50 miles out of his way to talk to this guy, you know? And I used to just say, well, I'm glad he's taking it to the streets and not to me, you know? But anyway, we've both mellowed each other out an awful lot. And of course, aging does that also, life. But so I went to a Rosh Hashanah dinner. I was born into two Jewish parents, but never really practiced it very well or much, and don't care to. It's lovely. It's fine. It's one of the many great teachings that I study from time to time. But I went to a dinner with a Hasidic family, and I always like them because I think they're kind of spiritual. You know, they do a lot of singing and whatever. And we all wished each other a happy, healthy new year. And I went to bed. My husband didn't go. And Henry is his name. And that night we went to bed. And in the morning I got up at about 5 o'clock. And he says to me to go to the bathroom. He says to me, don't mind the bathroom, it's nothing. So I go into the bathroom and there's blood everywhere. Everywhere. The commode, the sink, the floor with footprints, the shower, towels. And I am the greatest person to have in an emergency. So I went back to the bedroom and he had fallen asleep, and he really craves sleep. And he's always saying, all I need is sleep. Leave me alone. I just need sleep. So he was asleep. So I said, well, what can I do? 5 a.m. I went straight to the computer to find out how you clean up blood. You see, it's like crazy, you know? I'm going to find out that. I made my shopping list of things I got to buy. And then I called two different doctor's offices of his. Nobody's there. 8 o'clock called again. Nobody's there. Blah, blah, blah. And the thing is, we have a long history because he's had a lot of things go wrong with him. And we've had a lot of ambulances. And he's very proud and very macho and very stubborn. And he gets mad as hell if I ever call 911. I've still done it about 15 times because enough, I get scared. But I try to respect him and listen to him. He's a medical person. He's a veterinarian. So he thinks he can play his own doctor. So he has everything to say about, you know, he knows what's going on, right? So, but I'm panicking and just trying to breathe into it, let him sleep, get the doctor on the phone, yada, yada. 9 o'clock. He wakes up and he says, I said, I'm calling 911. Something's really wrong. And he says, no, you're not. Just help me to the bathroom and make me some tea and toast. So I help him to the bathroom, making him tea and toast. And I hear him fall. Oh, when I took him in, I said, don't close the door. I won't look, but don't close the door because then you'll be propped up against the door and I can't do nothing. So of course he's closed the door. So I hear him fall down. I go back in there. I can like squeeze in to throw him a cold towel because he has this basal vagal thing to put cold around his face, but I can't prop up his feet. And I said, I'm calling. Hey, you better not. I'll never speak to you again. All that stuff, right? Okay, great, great, great. And anyway, I called them. Fabulous young men. They came right away. They did cool stuff. And you will not believe this picture, but there's my husband laying on the floor in a pool of blood in a fetal position, naked. And he says to the EMT, she's such an alarmist. I mean, this is how nuts this guy is. This is how denial. I mean, God bless him and I love him, but I cannot listen to him. So anyway, we've had a week. He had to go to the emergency room a second time during the week, and things are looking pretty good. We have a month now to wait for another follow-up to see what's really going on. We don't quite know. The bleeding has subsided. I don't want to go into more details of his life, but so here we are. But I took care of business. You know, when they took him away in the ambulance, they said, call the emergency room in 2 hours. He's not getting a room for 2 hours. And I've been through this drill, right, with him. So I went out, I bought my products. I mop up the bathroom. Then I pull the covers away and he's got towels and sheets and everything, right? He's been bleeding all night. And I just threw everything away, got everything, blah, blah. But then later that afternoon, I'm talking with my sponsor and I just start sobbing. And I have memories back to my childhood, which some of you may relate to, but it was a wonderful experience. And these are the kind of things we get to learn about ourselves if we're not shoveling food in. If we let ourselves stay slightly raw to listen. So one scene was myself at 5 years old. My parents are beating each other up. I'm hearing that kind of pounding, banging, crashing. And I'm five and I go out into the hallway and I grab a broom that is twice as tall as I am. And I start sweeping up the broken glass in the hallway. And then I have another vision of myself when I'm 8 years old and my dog died being locked in the summer car during a baseball game. And I'm eight and the dog has certainly made a mess. She died in the car. And my father says, you help me clean this up. Again, like adult behavior asked of a suffering child, you know? And there was one other scene that came to me. I forget what it was, but just sobbing and sobbing about I never. And it's like when I was cleaning up this mess this week, it was like a meditation. As long as I can be busy, as long as I know what I got to do, as long as you give me something to be of service. It's no accident I became a therapist. I'm like such a helper bee, you know? And it was just a great, wonderful awakening for me, you know? And I've realized for the rest of the week, although ministering to him, how much self-care is so important. My sponsor says self-care is the final stage of recovery. So for you new guys, I hope this isn't getting too maudlin for you, but it's very important to face reality. And I've been in a bit of denial with him about how his situation's going. Anyway, So that's been my week, but things are good now. And for the past few years, I've tried, you know, I've spent a lot of my time spending more time with him, watching that football game. Although the Raiders won, that was fabulous. Anyway, you know, it's just realizing what I'm facing, what so many on this meeting have faced, and just about life. So a lot of times in these 47 years, I've had to surrender into the life that I was given. I've had to inhale my future. I've had to breathe into what's next. And that, you know, that's true now, but it's been true all this time. I've had such great practice in don't eat and inhale. And staying rigorously honest. There's a lovely woman on this meeting tonight that I love very much. And, you know, a couple weeks ago, I said, I've got to speak at this meeting where I have to speak for an hour. And I've been kind of loosey-goosey with being in New York all summer and whatever else. Can I email you my food? And she said, sure. You know, back to basics, what I did for the first 20 years is I emailed someone exactly what I ate every day. Crumbs, anything, slice, sliver, whatever. Not to be cool and not to look great, but to be rigorously honest about that. Because I'm the biggest con. You know, I used to say when I got here, I was such a brat, really, in a lot of ways. But I used to say, nobody got the best of her. That was going to be on my tombstone. Nobody got the best of her. And the truth is that I got the best of me most of the time. And especially in the food area, you know, I could convince myself, you know, I won't have that fish dinner. Instead, I'll have ice cream for dinner. You know, I could convince myself that ice cream was fish in an instant. You know, it's like all this kind of machinations, all this scientific nonsense. Please, please, if you're debating, I don't want to do OA because that one wants no sugar and that one wants fasting and that one, please. Those are all things we tell ourselves to block getting help. I don't want to be in the position of asking for help. I want to do it on my own, thank you. I got this. Thank God I had something in my life that I could not control and fix, that it drove me to my knees. And in these 47 years of imperfect abstinence, I've many times been driven to my knees about the food. You know, some of my greatest moments in recovery have been in the middle of a bag of trail mix. You know, when I decided that I could handle that. I just won't have dinner, blah, 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 blah. And I'm getting sick of it, but I'm still eating it. And somewhere, that spark says, call somebody. And I call somebody and I say, get me out of this bag of trail mix. And they help me walk it over to the sink because if I put it in the trash, I'm taking it out. We walk it to the sink. Garbage disposal. Finished. Next, move on. I don't count days. I don't say, oh my God, I was a bad girl. Man, all those years of my life as a dieting teenager and as a Weight Watcher 9 times and all the rest of it, they'd hand me a diet and they'd say, now are you good this week? Doctor's office, let's weigh you in and see if you were good this week. Shut up. We are not children and we're not buffoons and we know a hell of a lot, especially about nutrition. So stop the act about, I don't know what to do. Eat less and exercise more. You know what? That takes a village. That takes a village. You try eat less and exercise more, right? I have been coming to this village for 47 years, and I'm brilliant. I'm amazing. I've written 4 books. I've trained counselors all over the world. And I still need you and you and you and you and you and you. And I have all of your numbers, and I don't mind calling day or night. I have no ego about this illness. Of course, they say ego is edging God out and all that. You know, I don't particularly believe in God, but I believe in something. Now, you know, our literature says that we have a daily reprieve based on our fit spiritual condition. And how's that other part go? Oh my God, right at the beginning thing. But it says not just that, but anyway, that we're seeking a spiritual condition. And I've got some kind of concept about that about 2 years before I ever walked into an OA meeting. And I've told this story many times. I'll tell it real quick now because some of you have heard it a lot. But
you have about 15 minutes left, Judy.
Okay, thanks. Well, I was in New Delhi, India. I just had a fight in the bazaar with my husband. And he walked away from me in the middle of the bazaar in New Delhi. And I said, what? I'm not going to run after him. I've had enough of that. I'm shopping. So I continued to look at the batiks and kind of got lost in the bazaar. And I said, well, I have to go get some money. And so I walk over to the American Express office, and this lovely blonde guy opens the door, helps me in. Well, P.S., He was from Quebec. He was French. And long story short, by the end of the afternoon, when I thought he was taking me to have lunch at his friend's house, he was walking me in a wooded area in Delhi. And I looked at him and my whole body went, my body just started vibrating like birds jumping out of the bushes. And I said, this guy's going to hurt me. And he saw it. He knew that I knew. He came over and he pushed me. But because I was alerted, I didn't fall. I just stumbled. He stole my pocketbook. He ran away. And I, you know, long story. The next day, they advised we go to Thieves Market, where you can often buy back your stolen goods. So I did go there, but couldn't find them. I was helped by a nice Indian man, et cetera. My husband had found some drugs. He was happy. But I never forgot that my body had alerted me that I was an animal, you know, that there was another sense of things going on than my little brain knew about. And I remembered that there's some kind of other energy operating than just my brain. So when I got to OA and they said, you are going to seek a spiritual consciousness, you want to be connected that way, I said, yeah. And isn't it interesting that I have a malady where I'm trying to get my body in order? The body doesn't lie. The head lies. But the body is a perfect barometer when I am on the right track for my life or the wrong track. And that's what I want. I want to live up to my destiny, whatever it is. Whether it's by design or by destiny, I just want to be true to who I'm supposed to be. And that's what you guys keep helping me with. My sponsor is terrific. All of you friends here, you know, I call and we talk and the truth comes out. I'm seeking other truth seekers. There were many periods where I felt the only place people were being honest were at these meetings. I felt the rest of the world out there was gaming and manipulative and, you know, it takes one to know one. I mean, I certainly could smell out liars, cheats, and thieves because I wore one. But when I went to these meetings, I really believed people were being honest, and I also believed that they liked me and cared about me. Now, maybe that wasn't true in every case. Don't tell me. It's been such a good con that it has saved my life. So just keep being nice. Just like I try to do. Choose kindness. By the way, I was thinking today, I'm writing a book about the early days of treatment programs. I was there, so I've got a lot to say about some of this stuff. But, you know, I first started out in 1969 working for Mayor Lindsay's Addiction Services Agency, right out of undergrad school. And I helped build the Phoenix House programs, and our therapy was very confronted that we didn't want people to be living in their lies, and we would nail them on what they were saying and doing and thinking. And it allowed me to mobilize all the anger I was still handling. I didn't have real compassion. You know why? Because I hadn't struggled with trying to change myself. You know, once I was given direction on things I had to change here, I stopped telling my husband to stop drinking. I stopped telling anybody to do anything. I saw how hard it is, one day at a time to change my behavior. I'm on automatic all the time. So I have changed tremendously in this program. I usually choose kindness for myself and others. I have a lot of compassion. One of the great lines my first sponsor told me about, and she gave me a plaque, is the desiderata that says in that, beyond a wholesome discipline, be gentle with yourself. Beyond a wholesome discipline, be gentle with yourself. So that's what I've learned here. But I was a hellion. In the early days, and some people here worked with me in those days, and I was tough. You know, I counseled the Crip gangs when they were first starting out. I was leading groups with the Crips and psychodramas in juvenile hall, and I had the same level of anger as these patients, and I would meet them in that, and it was great because then they weren't afraid that I couldn't see them. They knew I could see them and feel them because I was one of them. So it was a strange juxtaposition of professional training and lunacy. It worked well for many of us. And today I don't have that, but someone was just recalling to me that in family group one time, we had a father who was doing his mansplaining to his family about yada, 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 yada. And you could see the kid's eyes glazing over, and you could see the wife getting more and more smoke out of her ears, you know, and he's just talking and dominating and stuff. So you know what I did? I just leaned over and fell out of my chair on the floor, like I had passed out. And I just laid there for a long time. And then the kids came over to try to revive me. And then, you know, I got up and I sat in the chair, and then the kids laughed and the wife laughed and even the father laughed, you know? But those are the kind of things I used to do. Very unorthodox. Never learned it in graduate school. Do not try this at home, folks, because people get mad at you. You have to be an angry enough person to meet their rage. Anyway, here I have all of these things. Another thing I wrote down here was keep announcing your intentions. Keep announcing your intentions. My sponsor is constantly asking me, what are your intentions here? You know, because usually often I try to cover up a bad motive with a kind of a whitewash, let's say. And I have to examine what I'm after. And am I choosing kindness? Now, for you guys who are new, I just want to give you one major warning. This program will really mess up your eating. Okay? You just cannot eat in the same old dishonest way. You start watching yourself shoveling. And that's why if the reality comes to you in the middle of a bag of trail mix, brava, bravo, you know? Great. Stop. Let's get back on. That's how I operate with people who call me full of remorse and beating themselves up. Our natural state is eating. Hello? So when you stop that for 5 minutes, it's fabulous. And you put together enough 5 minutes at a time and you end up being perfect like me. Anyway. So I try to live with rigorous honesty as best I can, and I have people I consult because then I have nothing to hide. You know, if there's something I haven't uncovered, it's not because of lack of trying. So I want you to point out if you think I have some devious motives or whatever it might be. I had things going on for years. I also did a lot of retreats for OA. And sometimes there'd be people be mad at me saying that I shouldn't be talking the way I was talking or saying what I was saying, or I wasn't quoting the big book enough or not too much. And by the way, I do quote the big book when I say I am a man who has grown new legs. I have grown new legs. I am a new person. I'm 77 years old. Hopefully something hit me while I've been here with you guys. Hopefully I can live without fear most of the time. So I know that's quite controversial. Thank you very much. I've heard the arguments, but I'm here to share my experience. And for me, I'm not afraid of any foods today. I eat everything, most of the time in moderation. I stay conscious. And I share with other OA people how I'm doing. Honestly. You know, I went to New York this summer. I had lost 2 pounds by the time I got to New York after driving across country with all kinds of restaurants. I was elated. I got back to California. I had regained that and 2 more pounds. Okay, so, I mean, who cares? Anyway, who cares? So I think I'm going to end with this. First, I'll end with two things, okay? I want to quote two things. One is, look it up on the internet, but Martha Graham was a very famous dancer, and her protege was Agnes DeMille, her student. And Agnes DeMille wrote her a letter, and she said, you know, I hate my dancing. I can't stand how I'm doing. I don't know what to do, blah, 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 blah. And Martha wrote her back this letter, which you can get on the internet. Just go Martha Graham letter. And she wrote her back this letter. She said, your job is to keep your expression totally yours, to keep it honest and let it channel through you. No artist is pleased. There's only a queer divine dissatisfaction that keeps us marching and makes us more alive than the rest. So we are here in these rooms not to have fellowship. It's not about fellowship. It's not about making friends. That's an added benefit. Not about weight loss. That's a good added benefit, a byproduct. But we're here about living our own truth, each of us individually. At least that's what's been taught to me. So if you believe your job is to make a new life here, grow into your new life, then you're an artist creating that life. And you're not always going to be pleased at who you are becoming. But you have to inhale into your future. So then the last thing, and this is from Thomas Wolfe's A Man of Full Measure, and they're making a series about it for Netflix soon. And here's what this guy says. And you know, Zeus is the god, right? The head big god in ancient Rome, in ancient Greece. So this guy says, I am completely tranquil. My body is nothing but a clay bowl with a quart of blood. And it's only on loan in the first place. But Zeus has given each of us a spark of divinity, the ability to say yes to what is true and no to what is false. And no one can take that away from you.